WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Richard Goodwin was at the center of national politics in the 1960s, in the White House with John F. Kennedy and Lyndon Johnson. Goodwin has written a political memoir about the decade titled Remembering America. His most controversial memories, memories he was reluctant to share until now, relate to President Johnson's behavior in the White House. Goodwin says he watched Johnson exhibit increasingly irrational and paranoid behavior and lose control of his political skills. Richard Goodwin first entered politics as John Kennedy's assistant speechwriter during his presidential campaign. He then became one of Kennedy's advisors on Latin American affairs. Goodwin coined the term Alliance for Progress and helped establish that program. As a speechwriter for President Johnson, Goodwin came up with the phrase, the Great Society. Goodwin opposed Johnson's increasing escalation of the Vietnam War and left him in 1965. He later worked on Eugene McCarthy's presidential campaign, and then he switched to Robert Kennedy's campaign. But after Kennedy's assassination, Richard Goodwin left politics. According to Goodwin, President Johnson had many eccentricities. The first time he called Goodwin in for a meeting, the meeting was held in the bathroom with the president sitting on the toilet. Goodwin has described this as a mysterious test.
I viewed it as the action of a really rather colorful, eccentric fellow. I also viewed it as a kind of a test. He wanted to see how you would react, whether you're able to hold on to your emotions or stability in a situation like that. To tell you the truth, it didn't bother me. I'd been in the Army. You know, I'd seen people on the toilet before. I didn't have any particular, except that it was unusual because he was President of the United States. But he told me a story at that time about another White House, one of those effete Kennedyites, as he called them, who had come in when he was on the toilet, and Johnson had said something, and he didn't hear the man's reply, and he said, would you come closer? He said, you know, that fellow just backed right up to me. He said, you'd think he'd never seen anybody perform in bodily functions before. It makes you wonder how he got along so well in the world.
So you think this was maybe a test to see if you were effete or not?
Well, I think it was a test to see whether or not you were able to keep your balance under a very unusual situation, and also whether you would tend to, how would you react to it? I mean, he was always, there was an undercurrent in Johnson, always, who felt that Easterners and Harvards, those Harvards as he called them, and looked down on him as a rough, ill-educated Texan, and he was trying to see if he could elicit that kind of a reaction by putting people in what, for some, I guess, was a rather extreme situation, which I didn't view that way.
When you went to work for Lyndon Johnson, he told you that he was going to pass all those bills that you cared about. He told you that Kennedy never really understood the Congress, and he did. Did he not respect Kennedy as a politician? I should say here, he also said that that he believed that all that charisma stuff was really a bunch of bull when it came to working Congress.
Well, I think Johnson, when he was vice president, of course, regarded his position as being rather humiliating and embarrassing, being lost in the glamour of what later was to be known as Camelot. I mean, Kennedy always tried to treat Johnson, I think, with respect and give him things to do. Robert Kennedy, on the other hand, I think, did not like Johnson, and Johnson knew that. But I think it was very hard for Johnson, when he became president, to live under, as it was for Nixon, who often talked about it later on, to live under the shadow of the kind of aura of glamour and everything that had come to surround the Kennedy administration. And I think Johnson set out to deal with that in the way he could most effectively, that is, through his performance. And in his first 2 years as president, I mean, he got more liberal legislation, progressive legislation through the Congress than at any time in the United States since the early days of the New Deal, since World War II. And he also did more for the cause of civil rights than any president since Abraham Lincoln. So there was some truth in what he said about his own ability to perform, but there always was over him. And I guess something that Nixon and others always had to deal with was the kind of aura that surrounded the, and still surrounds to some extent, as we can see, the Kennedy presidency.
My guest is Richard Goodwin, and he's written a memoir about his work in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and in the Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy presidential campaigns. The book is called Remembering America. Now, you also write about the increasingly irrational and paranoid behavior that Lyndon Johnson displayed. For instance, you say that he saw Bobby Kennedy as the leader of his enemies. What kind of conspiracy did he imagine Robert Kennedy was leading, as you understand?
Well, I think that in mid-65, as Johnson approached the decisions that would transform the Vietnamese war and the war in Vietnam into an American war to send large-scale combat troops, I think he alone among his advisors saw that this might destroy, as he said, the trumpets of war would destroy the might destroy his own hopes and ambitions for the country, which I think were very great and idealistic, and which I believed in. At that point, I think he did become, there were periodic episodes of irrational behavior. And one of them you've just mentioned, which is he talked about Robert Kennedy and Martin Luther King being enlisted together in a conspiracy to cause riots in the ghetto, to discredit his administration and to discredit his policies in Vietnam. At other times, he talked about it as a kind of communist conspiracy, being unwillingness to admit that his decreasing popularity in the country or that opposition to his policies was grounded in sincere and rational disagreement. He began to attribute it and to believe that it was the consequence of conspiracy. And those episodes, and they were only episodes because many times he was, much of the time, very firmly grounded in reality, began to worry not only me, but other members of the White House staff, and we discussed it with psychiatrists, and I left at the end of 65, so joined the anti-war movement in 66. But I gather from what people have written in recent weeks in response to my book that these episodes continued and even accelerated through 66 and 67.
Well, I should say here that members of the press had called Bill Moyers to corroborate your what you have to say about Johnson's growing irrationality and paranoia. And what Moyer said was that he'll tell whatever stories he has to tell in his own words, in his own time, when he decides to write about it. Were you surprised at that reaction, and do you feel that your story has been corroborated?
I was not surprised at that reaction. I think Bill is entitled to tell his own story in his own words. Everything I say in that book, whether it's about him or about me or our conversations and our conversations with other people, is absolutely accurate and honest, and he has not denied it. I think that's true. And the Boston Globe recently, Charles Peters, the editor of the Washington Monthly, writes that he had a conversation with one of Johnson's oldest and most trusted aides in 1967, after I was deep in the anti-war movement, and complaining about the policies in Vietnam, the man told him, "I think the president's going crazy." So, I mean, I don't know what was happening then, but there are obviously other people, and there's Hugh Seide in Time magazine himself has said that he and other members of the press felt that, yet nobody wrote it. And
why didn't you say anything at the time?
Well, as I said, finish that I regard as corroboration. Well, after I left the White House for a couple of years, there were several reasons. I have a lot of diary entries wondering about whether I should speak up about this. But first of all, of course, I'm not a doctor. I'm not a psychiatrist. I couldn't certainly prove that there was anything medically wrong with the President of the United States. Second of all, it was very doubtful in my mind that anybody would believe it if I did say it. They would regard it as a part of a politically motivated attack. We often said that when discussing this and while we're in the White House, that if we ever impaneled a jury of psychiatrists, that Lyndon would stand before them and say, "Those poor boys have just been misled after everything I've done for them, and they need help." And by the time we finished, the psychiatrist would end up committing us and sending him back to the Oval Office. But with all that, I think it may also, and with the fact that it would have caused us, I don't think that I could have proven the case. It still may have been a mistake, and I am free to admit now, 20 years after the fact, that I may have made a very large mistake of judgment, or I may have been rather timid. When you see the kind of mini-storm that's been kicked up by revelations that are 23 years old and the war is over and the president's dead, you can imagine the kind of storm it would have caused at the time, and maybe I was a little afraid of that. Maybe it wasn't a mistake. I don't know, that's the judgment, that's the judgment.
My guest is Richard Goodwin, and he's written a memoir about his work in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and in the campaigns of Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy. The book is called Remembering America. The paranoid and irrational behavior of Lyndon Johnson's that you describe, Did that tie in, do you think, to his decisions about escalating the war in Vietnam?
Well, I mean, you know, in all the pages, 200 pages that I wrote about Johnson, I mean, it's too much too easy to skip over the enormous accomplishments of the man before the war. And it's obviously that he was, although many have had eccentricities and peculiarities, he was pretty much in control of things. I think it's the stress, was the stresses of having, of feeling compelled to make those decisions. And most notably, mid-1965, when the decisions were being made for the first time to send large-scale American troops into combat. It was under those pressures of events that he couldn't control and he felt were threatening that I think that we began to witness these paranoid disruptions and incursions of Johnson's personality. And had that not happened, we might never have seen that, and he might have gone on to realize his great ambition, which was to out-Roosevelt. I think we have a case of an extraordinary man with a tragic flaw, and history colliding with that tragic flaw. And the result of that, of course, is classical tragedy, both for him and for the country, because the war, of course, did destroy the progress of the early 60s, and or a lot of it, in any event.
Was there a turning point for you when you worked for Johnson in your views on how he was handling the war? Was there a turning point when you realized the war was escalating beyond control and that there were secret bombings and other things that the public did not know about?
Well, in mid-1965, I left the White House at the end of 65. When I left, I thought the war was still a retrievable error, that somehow we would negotiate our way out with some kind of jerry-built compromise as we did in Laos or there. And I did not, at that point, if anybody had told me that in a year or two there'd be 500,000 men in combat and 58,000 Americans would be dead and hundreds of thousands of Asians, that did not occur to me. But it did occur to me that what I was involved in, which was the Great Society and Civil Rights, had come to a halt, and that pretty much was while I left. During 1966, observing the conduct of the war and the steady escalation, I became convinced, both from observing from the outside and from what I knew of Johnson's own personality, that he had set out to win what was essentially an unwinnable war, and that meant unlimited escalation. And it was at that point, really, from outside the White House, that I first made a public break with Johnson, then ended up joining the anti-war movement and leading the political movements against him or participating in them in 1967 and 68.
When you told Johnson that you were leaving the administration, he begged you to stay, he tore up your resignation, and then he told you that if you insisted on leaving, he would draft you.
Well, I'd already been in the Army, luckily, so I don't think he could have drafted me. I'd served for a couple of years in the peacetime Army, and that was when I was in law school. Just before law school.
About the same time
as Mike Dukakis. We were both in the Army around the same time. So I think that, it was at least half a joke. I don't know.
A joke or what?
I don't know. Uh-huh. I mean, he didn't draft me. So, you know, maybe he meant it. Maybe if he could have drafted. I think if he could have drafted me, he probably would have. But I couldn't think of any law under which he could draft me. I figured I remember we were walking along, and I said, well, if you draft me, why don't you at least make me a general? And he said, you don't want to be a general. He said, those heads are the ones that are going to roll. You better stay a private. So that was the end of that conversation. And I wasn't drafted.
I want to talk with you about your work with the Kennedys, but first we're going to take a short break. Richard Goodwin is my guest, the author of Remembering America, which is a memoir about his work in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and his work in the Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy presidential campaigns. More after the short break. This is Fresh Air. Richard Goodwin is my guest, who's written a memoir called Remembering America, A Voice from the 60s. When you left Lyndon Johnson's administration, you went to work for Robert Kennedy. And as you pointed out before, Johnson really thought of Bobby Kennedy as being the leader of a conspiracy against him. Did you feel like you were going over into what Johnson would perceive as enemy territory?
Well, because there was no Robert Kennedy campaign until 1968, Robert Kennedy was probably the closest personal friend I ever had in politics. I got to know him very well after I left the White House in 1965, spent a lot of time with him, had great admiration for him. But I did know that as soon as I became associated with him in any way, which I took a trip to South America with him in 66, for example, that Johnson would undoubtedly perceive that as joining the camp of his enemies, which is rather ironic because at the time Robert Kennedy had no intention of running against Johnson at all. That didn't happen until 68. But yes, I realized that that was going to happen. But once I broke on the issue of Vietnam and made a public speech against the war, it was just widely reported at the time, you know, in newspaper papers, I realized that, you know, once you opposed Johnson on Vietnam, that meant you were an enemy, and that relationship was over. So I don't think it was this, enduring Robert Kennedy, probably just, or being friendly with Robert Kennedy and working with him somewhat towards the same end, which was the end of the war, I'm sure aggravated that somewhat.
I'm interested in what you thought Robert Kennedy's feelings toward his late brother were when you started working with Robert Kennedy. As you point out, Bobby Kennedy was frequently used as the hatchet man, as the person who would take the blame, take the fall for something that John Kennedy might otherwise have been blamed for.
Well, I think that was sort of his role in a way, especially when he was Attorney General, as one story I have in there.
Was it willingly his role?
Well, I mean, he loved his brother, he admired his brother, and he felt that was the way he could be of service to his brother. That was fine. I'm sure it wasn't always fun for him to be out in front, but I remember sitting on the White House porch with John Kennedy and a group of Southern senators, and one of them turned to him and said, Mr. President, he says, I'm afraid I'm going to have to criticize you, and then there's civil rights. And John Kennedy looked up at him and says, can't you attack Bobby instead? And they all sort of laughed. But in a sense, that sums up. I mean, Bobby was out in front. He took the heat on a lot of things. But so did John Kennedy. I mean, he didn't try to blame his brother for the Bay of Pigs or for some of the other mistakes of the administration. But, I mean, I think Bobby was more than one. Bobby idolized his brother, admired him, and was absolutely, totally loyal and dedicated to him. And I think he played that role to some extent. He also had a very significant position of his own in the administration.
You were close to both of the Kennedys when they were assassinated, and I wonder what personal effect the assassinations had on you.
Well, I think the assassination of John Kennedy was like a thunderbolt, totally unexpected, something that came out of the blue. It was I go into it at some length, and it was an unbelievably, I felt it as a personal tragedy, but I think it was felt as a personal tragedy around the world. I mean, there's one story I have there about an American who was going through the Sudan and a remote river, and he hadn't heard any news, and he got to a small store to pick up some provisions, and the man wrote out the bill in pencil, and he drew a small black border around it. The American asked him, why are you doing that? And he said, haven't you heard, he said, the greatest man in the world is dead today. And I think it was sort of the first worldwide mourning in history, and for me it was a time of mourning. Robert Kennedy's death was in many ways a much more personal thing. I was much closer to him personally. We were closer to being of the same generation, not quite, but much more than with John Kennedy. I had spent a lot of time with him personally. I was with him when he died, both in the hotel and in the hospital. And to me, that was a great personal shock. And also, it happened in 1968, and it happened at a time when it looked like we might be able to overcome the damage that Vietnam had done to our hopes for the country. And then all of a sudden, Hugh King had died, and then a few months later, Bobby Kennedy died. And it was at that point I decided that I'd had enough of public life for a while, and withdrew and went to live in rural Maine and wrote about my experiences, but it was a personally devastating experience.
You say that you had become addicted to public life. Was it a hard addiction to break when you...
Well, I think bullets help break it, but I mean, I think that there's something intoxicating about being involved in public power and being involved in the city. You think, well, at least when you're in Washington, you think is the center of action. Later on, I came to realize that the center of action was with people like Betty Friedan writing The Feminine Mystique, and Martin Luther King in Birmingham, and Ralph Nader, and the great social movements of the 60s did not begin in the White House, yeah, with people like that.
Well, it's interesting that you say that. Do you think that a lot of people who are in the White House, who are in political power, don't really realize the movements and the power of the movements that are happening outside the White House?
Absolutely. I think that it's always one of the dangers why the White House should be kept as open a place as possible, and instead of becoming the kind of sealed sanctuary that it can become, that it became under Johnson when Vietnam came along, that it was under Nixon, because the fact is, it's an illusion to think you're running the country. The country is running you even more than you are. And as I said, the great social movements that have, which were the 60s, were the seedbed of so much change in this country. They had their beginnings a long way from Washington, or certainly a long way from the centers of government. And government then is forced to respond one way or another, hopefully, and responds constructively and positively to these movements.
Richard Goodwin is my guest, and we're discussing the subject of his new book, Remembering America, which is a memoir about his work in the Kennedy and Johnson administrations and his work in the campaigns of Robert Kennedy and Eugene McCarthy. You really got your start in the Kennedy administration as an assistant speechwriter working with Ted Sorensen during the Kennedy campaign. And I get the impression you are disturbed at how the role of speechwriters has changed over the years, that speechwriters used to be a lot closer to the policy making than they are now.
Well, I think that's what makes them effective. I mean, you go back to Roosevelt, people like Sam Rosenman, who worked with Roosevelt right up through Sorensen and Kennedy and through Johnson up until Nixon. The person who was a speechwriter, or the president's principal speechwriter or writers, was also deeply involved in the day-to-day formation of policy, went to cabinet meetings, worked closely with the president. The result was he knew what was happening. He had an idea what the president's thinking was, even what his cadences were, his voice cadences, his personal means of expression. And as a result was he was able to write speeches that really authentically reflected, even if in a heightened way, I mean, he had a job to do, the personality and the thinking and the values and the ideology of the man he worked for. When they finally moved the speechwriters out of the White House over the executive office building, I think this happened under Nixon, it became much harder to do that because you were writing for someone you hardly saw or hardly knew, and what you were doing was filtered through other aides, and therefore, I think if anybody compares the quality of eloquence in public life today with what it was in the 1960s, we can see the results.
When you were writing for Kennedy and Johnson, did you hear their voices in your head? Would you write for their cadences?
Very much so. I mean, you know, obviously that...
Can you compare a sentence or a paragraph that you wrote for Kennedy and Johnson and talk about why each fit the person you wrote it for?
Well, I don't have any text with me, but I think that, you know, Kennedy was fond of alliteration and, you know, I mean, one line that I wrote for him, I suppose it's lasted a little bit. Not much of this lasts for very long anyway. It's pretty transient stuff, but it's those who make peaceful revolutions impossible make violent revolutions inevitable. Now you see there that kind of apposition of phrases and everything that's characteristic of Kennedy, as we never negotiate out of fear, but never fear to negotiate, which is the line I didn't write. I wrote the first
one. A lot of parallelisms.
Parallelisms and appositions and that kind of thing. I think of Johnson, the most famous paragraph I think I ever wrote that Johnson used was, which he said, it's not just blacks, but all of us who must overcome the heritage of centuries of bigotry and injustice, and we shall overcome. He said that to a joint session of Congress. And Johnson's style was less convoluted, more simple, and straightforward. And it was more, that's the way Johnson thought and spoke. And it could be just as eloquent and forceful as Kennedy's. So that in a very, very different way, it was more a Roosevelt in tone. Kennedy had his unique kind of style.
You described Jack Valenti tallying up during one of Johnson's speeches the number of words per minute he got in and the number of interruptions for applause during the speech, and this divided into some kind of ratio. Was this a typical way that Johnson...
Well, Johnson liked to keep track of the number of times he was interrupted by applause. It gave him some sense of how his audience reacted. I think it's probably perfectly legitimate. You know, it's at least as legitimate as television and radio ratings. He was providing, it was his own little rating service he was carrying around with him, and from a live audience. Then, of course, he'd get the other ratings that came from people like you in broadcasting, but he did like to do that, that's right.
You spoke a little bit earlier about how the assassinations broke your addiction to public life, and I was wondering if it was in any way a relief to be out of what was called the establishment. And to be an individual voice and not the voice of an administration or the voice of a campaign.
Well, I think temperamentally I'm much more suited to that. Obviously, I found myself less and less suited to being a member of the establishment. I never was quite a member of the establishment. I was always kind of an outsider who was on the inside temperamentally. And I also found that the mores of bureaucracy, some of which I detail in the book, very difficult to deal with. My concept was that, I don't want to say it in a kind of a self-congratulatory way, but, you know, you just took the straight line was the shortest distance between two points, and you did it, and sometimes people got offended. So once I got out and I'm able to write on my own and I can say what I want, I'm fortunate enough to be able to have most of the things I write published, and I can speak out honestly and freely and suffer no retribution for it, and occasionally even make some money so that by doing it, so that I find that a much more comfortable way to be. In fact, if I had really had my full choice, I probably wouldn't be here at all today. I'd be home writing something. But everybody has to make a living.
Okay, well, I thank you for talking with us.
Thank you.
Richard Goodwin's new book, Remembering America, A Voice from the 60s, is published by Little Brown. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.